to order and ask that we, we're going to change the schedule a little bit. I believe there's, John has a commitment. We're going to ask him to come up, Sandra Bishop and John Fletcher. We'll have you come first, and then we'll move on from there. Welcome aboard.
Thank you, sir. Chair Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to address the committee today. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop, the government relations person for Container Recovery up in Portland. We call it CRINC. With me today, I have Mr. John Fletcher. John is the president of CRINC, and John will be making a short presentation about the operation of CRINC as one of the major recyclers in the state. And he'll talk a little bit about the context within which we operate, and then hopefully we'll leave time for any questions that you might have. As you know or have probably heard, CRINC recycles just under 3 million bottle bill covered containers per day, and as such one of the largest recycling operations in the state. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Fletcher.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson, other members of the committee. My name is John Fletcher, President of Container Recovery. Container Recovery is a cooperative corporation formed in 1987 by three beer wholesalers to put some efficiencies and some accountability into the redemption of containers. From that start in 1987, we now represent 17 different wholesaler bottlers and pick up, redeem, and process over 3 million containers a day, or put in dollar figures, about $150,000 a day in nickels. Our average employee count for 2004 was 114, with a payroll over $3.5 million. We operate on 9.2 acres located at 3900 Northwest Eon in the Northwest Industrial Area of Portland. We lease 29 semi-tractors, own 11 service vans, and 135 semi-trailers. We service 1,118 grocery stores in three primary counties and parts of three others. We manage a database of over 4,600 different UPC codes that change almost on a daily basis. In the calendar year 2004, the gross operating cost to the wholesalers, what they put in, was $9,584,000. That's what their cost was for us. There are four other companies similar to ours operating around the state, all distributor owned and operated. We redeemed our redemption rate, for the last 14 years based on distributor reported sales compared to our redemption numbers has averaged 98.13%. over the last 14 years.
Your business was 98.
That's what we've redeemed. That is Container Recovery 101.
And just to give you just a brief wrap-up, one of the most important elements of the operation of CRINC, I think, as John has said, is that this is a cooperative corporation that's set up by the beer and wine and the soda distributors. And so it is the responsibility of collecting, accounting for, and recycling all of the redeemed bottle bill containers rests with the industry at this point. And there is no public money used to make this system function at this point. That's why John was stressing the $9 million that the distributors are paying in to run the system. So we have some material which I will pass out, and then also if you have any questions, we're certainly more than welcome to answer, because I think John will have to answer most of the questions. So thank you.
Any questions?
Any questions?
Representative Lim.
Thank you, the Chair. And I'd like to know how do you operate. When you collect all the bottles, who do you give it to?
Chair Anderson, Representative Lim, I think I'm answering this question correctly.
I hope so.
It depends on the commodity of the container as to where it goes. 100% of the aluminum goes back to make more cans. 100% of the glass goes back to make more bottles.
Okay.
PET is a rather a wild card at times, and currently, because of economics, it is actually going offshore and being processed in China.
All right. Hello, Mr.
Hello.
Chair, when you collect the bottle, where do you get the money from? Do you get the exact amount of bottle you processed, or do you get the money from the wholesalers, whatever total amount they distribute, you are getting the total amount?
Chair Anderson, Representative Lim, that comes, the entire amount that we use to refund and to operate the company come from the wholesaler network.
Regardless, you collect the 100% or not, they just give you the 100%.
Yes.
Okay, so maybe less collection, maybe more profitable for your company.
I'm not sure how to answer that, but okay. if you look at the numbers, which I stated toward the end of my presentation, was that for the last 14 years, the return rate has averaged 98.13%, which means that there's less than 2% unredeemed.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Hello.
What percentage is coming from the Washington State?
We don't know that, and it would be difficult for us to tell because many containers have use of what they call multi-state deposit labels. So there can be containers come across the border which virtually cannot be identified as not being an Oregon container.
Okay, just follow up, Mr. Chair.
Good.
So what you are saying, 98%, is not necessarily from the Oregon state, including all other surrounding states, the county together.
If we were to make an educated, semi-educated guess on that number, we would say, and I have said before that I believe it probably runs 3 to 5%.
Okay.
It comes across border.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you, if you were the king of the empire, is this the best system? Is this the way you do it?
Chair Anderson, there's a yes and no in there. We've been doing it long enough. We're probably as efficient at it as we can be at this particular time. Is it the best way to do it on the big picture? No, because it's probably the most costly and least efficient method by which to return recycled material.
Okay. Is there a better system that you can just...
Well, I personally think that the best system is curbside. That's the easiest for the consumer. And with I think education would assure that we would get good recycling numbers.
The end result is to get the containers back.
In most cases, yes, but I can also qualify that in saying that there are some containers that I'm not sure it's best to get back. Because I'm not sure there's an end use for them. And that you get into that with some plastics.
And those should go into landfill?
Whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
May I follow up
yes.
on that? Chair Anderson, members of the committee, there were some questions on Tuesday after the recycling folks were talking about the trying to get the quality end commodity out of you're trying to keep materials out of the solid waste stream, but you're also trying to get a quality commodity that you can then do something with. And I think the way Crink is set up right now, the only plastic that is going through the plant is PET. So there were a lot of questions about, well, why not, you know, should my water bottle be in it? There are many different types of resins that are used for water bottles. It is not exclusively PET. The plastic resins are easily contaminated. So I think this is what John's alluding to when he's saying there are some containers you probably don't want in there. They're going to contaminate the higher quality plastic. So I think that's one of the nuances that unless you really understand the materials, you don't necessarily know. It seems simple. If a container looks like the other container, it should be in there, but it's actually a different material.
To follow up on that, Chairman Anderson, that when it's carbonated, it almost demands PET be used as a plastic container. If it's not carbonated, then any resin will work.
So the water containers get the cheaper plastics.
And it's all, I think, important to understand that one PVC container in a batch of 10,000 PET containers will contaminate all 10,000. That's what the plastic industry says.
Okay.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Last meeting of this committee, we discussed some point that the price of 5 cents should be increased, maybe even 20-some cents. And if you are profitable with 5 cents, is there any point we need to increase to even 6, 7, 10 cents? How do you interpret that?
Chairman Anderson, Representative Lynn, my answer to that would be that if you look again at our redemption rate at a nickel at 98.13%, if you move that to a dime, it'll probably go to 107 or 108%, and then we have to figure out who's going to pay the additional money that is not collected, because we're all, I think, familiar with the famous Steinfeld episode where they were filling a truck full of New York containers at a nickel to take to Michigan because they were worth a dime in Michigan. And moving, we are an island out here, unfortunately. We are the only state other than California that has any sort of redemption value to their container. And when you put us in that situation, moving the deposit to a dime will make dishonest people out of basically honest people.
Give me a little idea. The can is purchased, taken home, emptied, brought back to the, say, retailer. They process it through the machines, the automatic machines, take it out the backside. Goes to you?
Yes. In our area. In our
you
area.
Take it?
Well, we have to further process it when it comes back to our plant. The only thing the machines do at this time is save some space because they do flatten them, mm-hmm. and to account for the number of cans and bottles that go through them. But when we take them back to the plant, we still have to process them further. We turn them into bales. The aluminum goes into bales. Glass goes into cullet, and PET goes into bales.
And from where they go there to the metals industry or glass?
Yes. Like I said, we sell almost 100% of our aluminum to one of two aluminum processors that are can manufacturers. So it goes back into cans.
Okay.
Glass, with the exception of green, goes to Owens Brockway in northeast Portland. Green goes to a company called Strategic Materials, which in fact goes to California to make wine bottles, I understand. And then the PET, because of the cost of transporting it, the only major markets around for PET are on the East Coast, and they use it for carpet fiber. But the cost of transporting PET from here to there makes it prohibitive. So we're such located so close to the port that it's easier to load a container and put it on a ship and head for China.
Are there markets for the other plastics, or are they basically useless?
Markets for plastic are very volatile. At times, there's always a market for LDPE, which is milk jugs. There always seems to be a ready market for that. But when you get into some of the lesser known resins for reasons of cost, in many instances there is not a good enough market for those.
Okay. I guess my last question would be on the curbside. I see some problems with that in that I'd have to think people might go around at night collecting a lot of cans to turn in on their own if they're just out in the open. Would that be a problem, or is that already?
It certainly can be a problem, but if they are going around at night stealing them, they're probably doing it to sell the product back, which means it's going to get recycled anyway.
Come back.
So.
And the product from curbside would go to the recyclers, who would then sort out, mm-hmm. and then to the landfill or back to the metals.
Correct.
So you'd be essentially out of business, or you're...
Depending on how the whole process put together, yes.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Rosemont.
Thank you. I've toured the Quink facility, and it's very impressive. And I just was curious, are you at capacity now, or do you have the capacity to handle more material than you're currently getting?
Chair Anderson, Representative Rosenbaum, we are not at capacity for processing. We could probably process more. Where we have a problem is in the accounting portion, and when I say we handle over 4,600 UPC codes, that is a major, major job, and much more than that, and now we become... Now it becomes a burden to us.
Thank you.
Chair Anderson, and also I just want to say that Representative Nolan has also toured the plant, but there have been a couple of changes since the representatives have toured, and one of the things that has been added is an overhead line that it has automated the process a little bit more than it was before. But just to give you some idea of scale, and John will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the volume of materials, recycled commodities that pass through the plant would be about 2 rail car loads a day. I mean, of course, they're going out in 3 ways because of aluminum, plastic, and glass, but if you totaled it, it would be the equivalent of a couple of large rail cars, so it's a very large operation there. And I would just like to say that if the committee would like to do a field trip, you're more than welcome to tour the plant. We can set that up. It takes about an hour or so to go through, so, and any of you as individuals are also welcome.
Located in
Northwest.
That's Green Lakes District.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to, looks like it's a similar testimony, call Krista Nelson. Krista Mitchell, excuse me. I'd like you to come up and talk about refuse and recycling, I think. I'll keep on subject here while we're together.
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here today. I'm Kristen Mitchell with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. I've been the governmental affairs director there for, 12 years already. With me today, I have the president of our association, Tina French, who's also the president of her company, North Lincoln Sanitary Service in Lincoln City, who is also the proud winner of the 2004 Austin Family Businesses Award. So we're pretty proud of her for that.
Congratulations.
And I also have John Heyer, who is the vice president and general manager of Sanipac, Inc., which is the garbage and recycling company in Eugene and Springfield. He's been doing that job for 20 years, so we have some good experience here, and we brought him here because I bring the experts to answer the real questions. The Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association is comprised of about 180 members across the state of Oregon. Our regular members are the people that pick up your garbage and recyclables every day at your homes and in many of your businesses. They deliver those, depending on what they are, to a material recovery facility, which most of our members operate those facilities, or a transfer station where they may be reloaded and then taken to a final destination in a landfill or in Salem, a waste energy facility. They are mostly, or many of them, are locally owned small businesses that have been doing this for a number of years. I believe Tina would be second generation in her business, but we have some that are third or fourth. We process and collect most of the residential and commercial refuse recyclables in the state and are proud to be doing this business. And we usually think if we're doing our job right, you may not even know we're out there because we come early and we're not there very long and we keep moving.
Sometimes too early.
You know, we hear that sometimes. And we try and deal with noise issues, but occasionally we do hear about that. I provided some information to you that just describes who our board is and our governmental affairs committee and staff, and then also information about, you know, who regulates us and how we do what we do and what we're doing out there. So if you have any questions, please feel free to call anytime. We're pretty proud of our work that we've done in the last at least 15 years related to recycling. And you probably will hear this number again, but the current number for 2003, which is the numbers that they have that are the best numbers right now, show that the statewide recycling rate is about 47.3%. And that's because the legislature in previous years, in 1991, in fact, put a plan in place that said that this state would step up and do curbside recycling in communities over 4,000, and we'd find programs to get it done. And this legislature also set a goal of hitting a 50% waste recovery goal at that time by the year 2000. And that was back in 1991. So we who work with our local governments, our counties and cities to put together programs, did that, went to them and worked to get those programs in place. And I believe the compliance on having a curbside program or a confirmed and allowed alternative that the EQC will accept is at 100%. Most communities have the curbside collection, but there are some communities that have chosen to do their collection in other ways. I think the most recent and more innovative thing that you've seen from our companies in the last couple of years is a move to commingling the recyclables. We don't mix them with the garbage. What we do is, in many cases, give the customer a container. It can be up to a 90-gallon bin. From where I live in Salem, that's what we have. It's a big blue bin. And we can put everything in that bin that is accepted for recyclable in Salem, Oregon, except for glass, which we keep separate on the side because glass can be a real contaminant to fiber. And that's one of our strongest markets, and we want to do the best we can to deliver a nice, clean product to the markets that we serve. And then depending on the local community, you can have different types of things available curbside. It just depends on where you live. And one of the factors that I think you asked about on Tuesday is obviously the economics of the program. It depends on where you live. The density of the community, how many customers you have for a base, because how are you going to spread the cost of doing this across that base? So those are things that the city and county decide is what kind of programs we'll provide, and then we're the ones that go out and generally provide those programs. Recycling is a commodities market, and I think you heard from the previous speaker, it can fluctuate, as most commodities can. So we have real ups and downs that in the market, but we're there collecting the materials all the time. Currently, we're trying to deal with our wood waste, and we've been pretty successful at going out and getting programs to keep wood out of the landfills, which is great because that's a big, heavy material that can be put to other uses. For a number of years, they've gone into hog fuel in the mills. It's been an alternative source of energy. But as the mills move over to natural gas base, and if I'm wrong, somebody will correct me, I'm sure, I don't think they have the capability to go back and forth. So the wood markets that we have, we're concerned about them dropping off. So we're trying to find alternative ways to deal with that. One of those may be that we're able to compost more wood in the system than we have currently, and we're participating with the DEQ and some compost rules that may allow for that revision to occur, at least will allow us to have the discussion about whether that can happen. So when you ask the question, what's left to recovery if we're trying to hit our 50% goal, there's food waste, organic waste, something that the Portland area has been looking at and trying to get their arms around how they would do that kind of a program. They've been doing that for quite a while, and that is one of the reasons that we've been participating with the DEQ on compost rule revisions, because when the compost rules originally went in place, they were really talking about yard debris and things like that. And when you start adding food waste, that's a different component. It's something you have to pay attention to how you deal with it, because you can have vector and health and safety issues that you just have to deal with and be careful with. Another thing that's gotten a lot of discussion, and in fact during the last legislative session there was a work group formed, is on electronics recovery, and John participated in the Senate Bill 867 work group that talked about those things. And we kind of view our role in all of these things as just kind of providing technical advice to you on how it would work in our system, what we think the kind of costs would be involved, and how we would go about doing that. So that's what John's role has been there. As far as what else is important to ORA members, transportation issues, we've been supporters of the OTIA bills in the last two sessions, and we're happy to step up and pay our share for better roads. And it's fun to drive through Oregon and see the signs that say this project is funded by OTIA, and know that you had a little piece in that. And I think you should all be proud of those votes that have put those dollars on the road, because I think it's going to make a huge difference in our economy and certainly for our roads. We're on all the roads. We're on the city streets. We're on the county roads. You'll see us on the highway and the freeway. In my town, and from my example in Salem, on my garbage day, if it's also a recycling day, there can be three trucks that come up my street to collect first my garbage or my yard debris, and then my my recycling as well. And all of those have moved to automation in Salem, which is another great thing for us, because another thing we are concerned about is workers' comp. We obviously have people that are in a business that, until you automate, there's a lot of repetitive motion, and we try and take care of our employees. They're important to us, and one of the ways that we've been able to maintain our costs and take care of things is by moving to more automation. So that's something that we pay attention to. We were actually a supporter of SAFE and always have been. They've been there for us, and we try and be there for them on issues, because it's been important to our industry to have affordable workers' comp insurance. Diesel engine stuff, that's a new change that's coming down the road, and emissions, and we're participating in those. I know that the DEQs, and through the OTIA bill, there's been the possibility of getting tax credits for refitting your trucks for those engines, and we are going to try and take some advantage of those programs and do that too. You asked if there were areas that we see for improvement. A couple things, and I'm not sure that it'll be appropriate for the committee, but at least it's something to raise. It sometimes is surprising to people that we are strong proponents of enforcement by the DEQ, but there's a very clear reason for that when you understand it. We are very heavily regulated all the way from the EPA through the DEQ, then to our local jurisdictions, and we play by the rules. We have permits. We have open books for people to see what we're doing. We've had some trouble in different areas of people that have land and a big hole in the ground and want to put something in it. And when that competes against us, when we have to meet the standards of the state and they aren't, that's a problem. And because we're permitted, I think the DEQ can very easily come and see what we're doing. When a site is not permitted, you have to go through a different process, like go to a judge and show cause that there may be something going on that's illegal. And we've worked with the DEQ trying to figure out a way to do a better job of getting to those enforcement sites, because frankly, if you don't get to a site, maybe even in the same day, it can be buried and gone, and you won't even know it's there. So you have to be able to respond quickly and get there and see what's happening. And we're not talking about somebody next door burying a few things in the ground. We're talking about major tonnage of materials that's disappearing, that's competing against us that we can't meet. So that's been an issue of concern for us. And then another thing that we would like to work with the DEQ on is getting a better grip on the recovery rate process. We do these numbers every year to try and say, here's where we are in our communities, here's how much we've taken out of the waste. We submit our numbers by February, and we have a couple issues. One of is timeliness. We aren't getting the numbers back quick enough to really be able to look at them to respond. And another is methodology. We think that maybe when the DEQ started this and with what they had, their computer system just doesn't quite meet the goals it used to, and it's probably time to look at how that works. So there may be a potential for a fix in that. And I guess on the one other thing I would say about the bottle bill, because I know there's been a lot of interest in this committee about that, we kind of view ourselves as, once again, sort of technical advisors on it. We aren't really in that discussion, other than when you suggest things like, what if they go curbside, then obviously we have an interest, and our job, I think, is to tell you how that would affect us. There are some that have suggested that if the bottle bill went away, it could come to the curbside. And you know, as far as practicality, it could do that. But there would be a cost related to that. There would be different types of materials that we'd be collecting. Obviously, there'd be an offset in some of those materials because they have value. But the biggest issue for us would be to try and take a bottle bill deposit system and move it curbside, yet maintain the deposit. For us, that's the one thing that we don't see as working at all. Because we've moved to automation in a lot of places, and even where we haven't, we're not at a stop more than 15 or 20 seconds. And to have to get out and look at the cans and say, okay, well, this is a non-deposit, this one isn't, here's 5, 10, 15 to Mrs. Smith on this bill, it's just, for us, it's not something that would be very feasible for us to do. So that's just a brief thing on that. And with that, I will turn it over to John.
I won't take up much of your time. I am the Vice President and General Manager of Santac. We are one of the largest privately held companies in the state of Oregon. We are locally owned and operated in Eugene. And by that, I mean the family who owns Santac lives in Eugene, for the most part. Phil is very familiar with our company. Phil and I are Rotary members. We are one of seven haulers in the city of Eugene. However, we do collect about 85% of the residential services in Eugene, so it's about 49,000 between Eugene and Springfield homes a week. And we serve about 80% of the commercial business in Eugene. We are also charged with the responsibility of being the franchise holder for the city of Springfield. And the franchise system is basically how most of the state of Oregon, except for a few cities, handles recycling issues and any other solid waste and recycling issues. That's how a city gets the job done, is through their agreements and franchise licenses. Santac, we run about 70 trucks a day. We drive about 80,000 miles per month. We pay our county about $4.5 million a year for disposal. We pay the cities of Eugene and Springfield about $500,000 a year in license fees and franchise fees. And we have about over 130 employees, and our payroll expenses are over $5 million a year. So managing a company of this sort with these type of logistics, there's not much that goes on here in Salem that can't affect my company. But our key focus is on garbage and recycling, and that's why I'm involved in the ORA. I must tell you that recycling has been the fun part of all of this. I mean, really, I have been with Santac for 20 years, and I have not once yet, and I don't think I'm here to talk too much about garbage, it's about recycling. I've never been asked to go to a meeting, and I speak to a lot of groups, but I've never been asked to talk about garbage. It has been the recycling. And over the last 20 years, I'd say, I'm 12, 15 years, that's been ORA's focus, has been the recycling. And the biggest reason for that is because our customers and your constituents want us to focus on the recycling portion of our business. That has been the key focus of what the garbage man is. It gives him the ability, if he wants to take the ability and the opportunity, to wear a white hat. Our biggest thing that we've ever done in our company started last January 1st, 2004, when we unleashed on the cities of Eugene and Springfield commingled recycling. And it has been a huge success. We have received, our increased recovery went up 30% in the first year. And what we're really finding is as the quarters go by, it's getting bigger. There was love flying everywhere in Eugene and Springfield. Everyone loved it.
Love in Wayne County, imagine that.
I've been called an idiot and a visionary. I prefer visionary. There's been some talk about the size of the container, but now everyone loves the big 90-gallon cart. And it has really been a great boon for us. We bought 49,000 carts all in one day. Didn't deliver them all in one day. Seven new trucks, the largest economic commitment we've ever made, and it has done nothing but good things for us and our image. I'm the chairman of the Governmental Affairs Committee for ORA, and because of what goes on up here in Salem. It's very important to my company, the ORA group, our Governmental Affairs Committee. Sees this as our ability to be able to stand at the cutting edge of the issues that are in front of you and can be in front of us. In essence, we as the haulers, as our group says, we work for you guys. And it keeps me out there in front of these issues. What do I see as the big things coming down the pike? Food waste and electronics recycling. Those are the big ones I see out there as issues with a whole bunch of different variety of issues are surrounding them. Those are the two big ones that are coming up. And Kristen alluded to the fact of the compost rules regarding food waste and some of the concerns that we have for that. Being in front of you and other groups that who asked me to speak is probably the most fun part of my job. So I'll tell you this right now. I'm here anytime you want me, and I'm sure Kristen will be here anytime you want us. And if you have any questions later on, love to talk to you for an hour, hour and a half, whatever you got.
John, you gave your name at the beginning. Would you just give it again for the record?
It's John Heyer.
Heyer. Mr. Chair? Yes, Representative. Correct.
John, in the spirit of legislative credibility and the breaking of your streak, how's the garbage business?
The garbage business is very stable. The piece of the business that maybe you were just joking. Like I said, don't get me started.
Yes, no, I was joking.
It's picking
nice
up.
Nice one.
Good afternoon, Representative Anderson, committee members. I'm Tina French from Lincoln City. I am the president of North Lincoln Sanitary and currently president of the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. And I represent a very different community than John does and a very different business. We are a small, privately held business in our city. We've been family-owned for nearly 40 years now. We have 20 employees with over $1 million in payroll. We run currently about 15 trucks in our area and pick up around 10,000 customers, both residential and commercial, and as I'm sure you're aware, that fluctuates heavily depending on the season. We have implemented several recycling programs in our area in the past 5 to 8 years that have helped us enjoy a great recovery rate in our area. We have surpassed our goals set for our waste shed each and every year since it has been set by the legislature back in 1987, I believe. 91. We have commingled recycling at the curb. We started that program just a little over 2 years ago, and as John alluded to, that has significantly helped our recovery rate at the curb. We are not automated at the curb at this time, but that is something that we are looking into. We have a fairly large wood waste recovery program in our city. We this year recovered over 4,164 tons of recycling, of which almost half of that is wood. So as Kristen said, that is a big commodity in our area, and we enjoy the benefit of being able to count that towards our recovery rate. We have an e-waste recycling program in our company. We also do things like latex paint, batteries, and other items that you don't typically see at some of the larger companies. Since we are small enough, we can handle those things and be a little custom for our customers. So those are some of the special recycling things that we do that we're fairly proud of for the size of company and the size of community that we represent. We highly value the relationships that we have with our local city, county, and even state representatives. We work very closely with them to provide programs for our customers to increase recycling. Customers like recycling, and there's no doubt about that. But with that comes a price, and so we're very sensitive to the rate that we charge to make sure that it doesn't outweigh the benefit. Recycling is a great thing, but I don't think that we ever want to allude to you or our customers that it's free, which has been kind of an uphill battle for us in the past few years. But I think that customers and the general population is starting to understand that it costs something to do the right thing with your garbage. A couple of challenges that we are constantly battling I'll allude back to is with the wood waste recovery program. In Lincoln City, we have three major illegal non-permitted sites that we have a challenge with that bought a large piece of property, and you see dump trucks, 40-yard end dumps, pickup trucks going in and out of there every day with wood waste that is not being counted and that is being burned generally or buried, as Kristen alluded to. And that's a challenge for us. It's also a challenge for contractors in our area that know that they need to do the right thing. If they're trying to bid against ABC Company, who is getting rid of their stuff for half of what they can get rid of it for at a permitted site, that's a disadvantage to them and a challenge for them. And instead of calling the DEQ, they call me and, you know, complain. And so I try to keep up on that. It's not something I probably have to do, but it's a frustration to us because as we see our numbers decline in our wood waste recovery program, I see the piles at the illegal dump sites growing. And so that's a frustration for us that we deal with, I would say, on a daily, if not weekly, basis. And the recovery rates is not as much of a daily frustration for us, but it is something that we work really hard to keep track of our numbers, to report our numbers on a timely and correct manner. And when they come out significantly later and not correct, it's a little bit of a frustration to us. Generally, the papers and the cities get a hold of that information before we see it, and so then that information is published, and once it's published incorrectly, we all know what happens as far as getting it out there correctly. So that's a frustration with us. I look forward to working with some of the new leadership in the DEQ and maybe getting some of those things corrected. Kristen and Max do a great job, have a great relationship with DEQ, and I think it's something that we can correct, and it sounds like that they are wanting to correct. And so that's all I have, and I appreciate the opportunity. Again, if you ever have a question, I know that any one of our members would be happy to talk to you, but specifically any of our staff members or John or I are always here.
Question, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just wanted to say to the committee that John Heyer is exactly as he has described himself. He does enjoy talking about the recycling business, and he does a very good job of it. I will say this too, John, that when your 90-gallon cans first came out, there was a lot of grousing and griping about where people were going to put the thing. I haven't heard any of that lately because it's so convenient to use them. So they may not be in the best.
Quite the village idiot I was for a while.
Yes.
Yeah, that, I feel good.
Thank you. I wasn't going to say it quite that way, but that's certainly the import. The import of it. The question I have actually, though, is for the other end of the table, and that is what ought we to be doing in terms of enforcement? We mean the state of Oregon or local authorities or whoever, to deal with this illegal dumping problem. You mentioned it twice in your in your presentation. It sounds like there are two different kinds of things. One is stuff that gets buried, and the other is recyclable material that is wasted and burned.
Correct.
What should we be doing differently?
I think there's a couple issues. One of the issues, and I didn't mention it, and I know Kristen didn't mention it, with the illegal dumping, is one of the major concerns I have that would probably affect your committee more than anything is, so, in one case, we have a great story out of, is it Clatsop County, Seaside area? What county it was? A whole building coming down in a matter of hours and being buried within hours. And you're talking asbestos, wiring, roofing, you know, not just inert material. And so that's a major concern, is when you see whole buildings disappear in a matter of hours, you know that they're not being separated out and buried correctly. With regards to the wood waste that we're losing recovery numbers on for the state recovery number, I think it's a matter of, and I don't understand state statute exactly, but from what I understand, since they are not a permitted site, DEQ cannot waltz onto their property like they can waltz onto my property and see what's happening. So therefore, they have to go through a channel of getting a court order from a judge to be able to go onto that property to prove to them. And as Kristen alluded to, we don't have time for that. This is something that, you know, there's large equipment on the, or a great example in my area is rock pits that are no longer producing rock, and the owner's looking for a way to get revenue, and, oh, I have a large hole, I can charge a tip fee to the contractors in our area, and pretty soon their hole is a landfill, and they're, you know, getting money. But again, it's the way that I understand that, you know, when I call DEQ and ask a technical assistant, who is generally the person that handles these things, to take care of it, she writes a letter, very nice, that says, you know, we've heard that you're doing this. If you are, please don't, and we'll check back with you in a few weeks. And, you know, it looks really good on paper, but, if you're looking at a contractor that owns, you know, 40 acres that's bringing in six figures a year in tip fees, they don't care. So specifically what you can do, I'm not sure how your...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I might follow that line of questioning just a little bit. Thank you for that. And I have no idea if this makes sense, but are there areas that we could address in terms of the acceptability of, for example, photographic evidence, so that we would not have to have someone on site instantly, but if you or a neighbor saw this activity, is there something that we could legislate that would help the regulatory agencies use that in a way that was productive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think that as far as our group, we'd be open to any way to try and help speed up the process, and that would certainly be something we'd consider. I know that under Stephanie Halleck as the DEQ director, they've brought the enforcement group into her office to raise, I think, the awareness of it. I just think that a part of the problem is for us, our issues maybe aren't as environmentally great in some ways as some other potential people that are out there violating, so I think you maybe make a call on where you want to spend your limited resources. So one of the things we'd like to do is work with them on better or quicker or more innovative ways to try and get people out to those sites and train them, and maybe a photographic way would be a good way to do it. We'd just like to have that discussion and see if we can get some movement on it. That'd be great. And it may not be that we need to do it through legislative fix, but when you're asking about the things that are kind of grind, I think that would probably be one of them. So, thanks.
We have a very well-educated staff member on this subject. John, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Church. Very quickly, committee members, just on the food waste issue, I've learned that Metro in Portland will begin accepting source-separated food waste at its Metro Central transfer station beginning this coming Monday, and that material will then be sent to a processing facility outside of Seattle. The processing facility has indicated that if Metro can reach a critical mass of collected material in the Portland area, that they would be willing to construct a processing facility in the Portland area at some time in the future.
Excellent. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is not the recycling issue, it is the noise issue. I think someone mentioned just a little bit. When I was staying at the Salem Winter Street Lisa apartment, around 4 o'clock in the morning, big dumpster coming up and a big institutional size of a dump just going. You can hear the sound from miles away. And certainly every morning it wakes me up. And I also complain from my constituents, such as near a shopping center area, near a hotel, maybe near Costco, some area. There's hotels and residents nearby. And then customers wake up in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock. How do you handle those situations?
I can tell you specifically for our company, Representative Lim, we are in a high tourist area with lots of hotels and commercial and residential integrated in areas like you're talking about, a little bit different than in metro areas. But we try very hard to accommodate each customer on a complaint basis almost daily. You know, if we can reroute a truck, we can. The problem with doing it, you know, after 8 o'clock, obviously, is access. You know, when you have traffic and you're backing in off of highways and backing out onto highways and backing into facilities, you know, we have to be very careful there because, you know, we have to have access to these containers. And, you know, right currently we have, you know, great building codes and so on and so forth to where access is, you know, much more accommodating for our type of vehicles. But in areas that are, you know, 40, 50, 70 years old, we have vessels at every size and capability and sometimes in very inconvenient places, both for us and for the customers, but that's just the way it is. So we try very hard, and I know as president of our association, our membership tries very hard. It's something that we discuss at almost each and every meeting as ways to keep our trucks quiet or keep our containers quiet or putting things on our both our containers and our trucks to keep them quieter, backup beepers, you know, specialized backup beepers that are quieter. But safety has to be definitely one of our high priorities, too, and that's the reason for the early morning routes. And I don't know if John has anything more to add to that.
Well, you do move around. I mean, if you get some of those kind of complaints, you do try to move them around. You know, we get pretty tricky, too. You can also go out and pick up some other accounts that are out in the middle of nowhere in the commercial sector to make it softer in your truck.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds pretty basic, but that's what we do for a living. And you dump the stuff at these noisier places on soft garbage, is one we found out. And we really do try to stay out of places. The Hilton Hotel is the big one. And we stay away from that area. The hospital is the other one we stay away from. And so we really do try to reroute the things based on things. But the big one is the accessibility. And it's not just the accessibility in the parking lot, because some of these places are kind of, the garbage became an afterthought, are stuck in a corner someplace, you can't get in there with the cars. So it's just, it's a fine line. And we deal with every complaint that comes by. It is a complaint-driven portion of what we do for a living.
Okay, may I make a comment? I think that what I understand, the noise not coming from necessarily from the content of the garbage, but from the container, truck, and when they pick up and down it, oh, it makes tons of noise you can hear.
Plastic lids is a good one. You can put one of the things that we're looking at now is I'm going to call it plastic, but it's some real kind of hard plastic, rubbery stuff on the fork so that when the sleeve, when it comes up, it doesn't hit. Try and do that. One thing coupled up with that problem is the fire marshal rules, that when you have a container at a multifamily place or a business, if it has residential people around it, it has to be a metal container with metal lids for fire containment. Mm-hmm. Plastic lids won't work. So you deal with that. But you're right, a lot of it can be the container itself. And when the thing tips and it comes back down, the slam of the...
Exactly.
Right. We're working on that. And even if you have a metal one, we're thinking of maybe, it's not spun driver, but we're thinking about some things there that when that thing hits, it's less... Sometimes you can speed up your pumps, you can roll it real quick. So, and good, real good driver helps out a lot, too.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You. He can talk for hours about garbage.
Sorry. I think we're going to want to have some future conversations regarding possibly cans and glass and plastic being done curbside. We'll get into that a later time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much.
Call Terry Witt, and is your colleague here with you? Or?
No, she's also today.
You're covering. Oh, gosh. Too bad.
Going solo today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter, or OFS for short. Paulette extends her apologies. She's homesick, and basically I ordered her to stay home in bed so she wouldn't infect the rest of the natural resource building. What I'd like to do is to take a little bit of time today, talk a little bit about what OFS is, perhaps a little bit about what OFS is not, and then a little bit about some of our legislative priorities or issues of concern for this session, and then obviously open it up for any questions that you might have. This year, 2005, is OFS's 25th year in existence. We were formed in 1980, and we were actually formed as a ballot initiative committee. There was an initiative proposed to ban the aerial application of phenoxy herbicides, primarily 2,4-D, in forced applications in the state of Oregon. I won't go into the whole details of that ballot measure, but needless to say, there was a certain segment of society that did not want to see 24D being applied in public forest lands because they were growing a crop of their own that sometimes is called weed, and it's not a noxious weed, but it was a weed that was being cultivated. And 2,4-D is extremely detrimental to cannabis. You just speak the word and sometimes it will wither the plant. So that was really the genesis for the start of OFS, and the organization was really put together as a coalition builder to unite both the forest herbicide users and the agricultural herbicide users to defend this technology or this tool. After the initiative process was over and OFS was successful in educating the public, the organization continued on because the principals that were involved in funding the campaign realized that the confrontation, so to speak, between certain interest groups and user communities was not going to go away, and there was a definite need for education about the balance, about the benefits of pesticides as opposed to strictly talking about the potential risks. That's how we were started. We currently have three staff members, myself as executive director. I've been with OFS for 18 years. Paulette Pyle is our director of grassroots. She's been with OFS since it started for 25 years. And Sandy Schuchler, who is our office manager, who comes from a family-owned logging enterprise and has been with OFS, as I said, for 12 years. You all know Paulette, I'm sure, and Paulette handles most of the face-to-face lobbying and vote counting on our issues. I do primarily most of the testimony, both written and oral, and as Paulette says, I'm her technical arm. Just briefly, let me say what we are not. Those who oppose us or those who find themselves at odds with us or at battle with us like to classify us as a front for the chemical industry. I've seen that quote used many a times. We are not a front for the chemical industry. If we represent one entity, I would say we represent the user community of agrochemical tools, and that represents agriculture, forestry, urban, and even the public use of agrochemical tools. We are made up and governed by a 31-member board of directors. It's a voluntary board of directors, and just to demonstrate that we are not a front for the chemical industry. Of our 31 members, let me give you a quick rundown. 9 are agricultural production representatives. 3 are food processors. 4 represent large timber concerns. 3 represent family-owned timber companies. 2 are in general business, primarily transportation. 3 are industrial vegetation management representatives. 2 are professional applicator association representatives. And there are 5 that represent agrochemicals on our board of directors, and that includes both pesticides and fertilizers from the manufacturing and distribution end. So basically, less than 20% of our board of directors represents manufacturing and distribution of pesticides and fertilizers. And we have we operate on a consensus basis, one board member, one vote. So I think you can see from the numbers that we do not solely represent, nor are we a front for the chemical industry. The other thing that we do not do, which I think is very, very important to understand, is that we do not defend nor support the unlawful use of pesticides or fertilizers. Those who break the law, which includes using materials off-label, which is a violation of the law, those folks do not defend those folks. They deserve to be have enforcement action taken against them, and we will work with the Department of Agriculture or US EPA, whichever the appropriate agency may be, to see that they get what's due them. That being said, what have we done or what do we do? I thought it was kind of interesting. I kind of ran through some of the things that we've been involved in since OFS has started. And it goes back to 1985 when my predecessor, Dave Dietz, was instrumental in writing and passing the Oregon Community Right to Know Act. In 1989, we were one of the principal parties involved in writing and passing the organic food certification law. In 89, we were one of the lead organizations in the Oregon Agricultural Groundwater Protection Act, otherwise known as Senate Bill 1010. In 1991, we passed, along with Oregon Environmental Council, the Oregon Integrated Pest Management Policy Act, the IPM bill. In 93, we helped to amend the state right to farm statutes. 1996, during the interim, we helped pass a voluntary wellhead protection program that went into effect in Oregon, one of the first in the country. In 1997, we supported the Oregon Plan. In 1999, we were involved in helping to draft the Oregon Pesticide Use Reporting Act, which since then has fallen on some hard times, and I'm sure we'll probably get some questions on that a little bit later. We've been involved in successfully helping to lobby for tens of millions of dollars for the OSU research facilities in the state of Oregon. In 2001, along with Representative Nolan, we passed a new fertilizer law to regulate the use of fertilizers and report or make known to the public the heavy metal contents of fertilizers. We've done a lot of other things, including support research dollars that went into investigations for the fish deformities in the Newburgh Pool, those kinds of activities which we believe were valid and warranted use of limited resources. So I think from this type of broad overview of some of the legislation and bills that we supported, you can see that we don't just take a position of and say no to everything that is proposed. We take a look at it from a technical perspective. Our major concern, to be very frank with you, is we want to build coalitions within the natural resource industry to basically help those people survive in an era of potentially over-regulation, and that's what we try to do. We focus very heavily on agrochemicals, which includes the herbicides and pesticides. We also look at fertilizers, and the new technology on the block is biotechnology, the genetic modification of organisms. This is a form of pest management, and we get involved in a lot of other things that perhaps sound like they don't necessarily fit the OFS mission, but we get involved in things like trapping issues, because trapping really is a form of pest management, both in urban environments and in natural resource settings. With that, where are we this session in terms of some of our key priorities? I think number one, it's probably a priority with everyone, and that's budgets. Where do we go with budgets, particularly general fund dollars for important programs like food safety, programs like the Pesticide Control Act, and we will work with and will be working with the Department of Agriculture to ensure that they do have the funding necessary to continue the work of that base pesticide program, which includes monitoring and enforcement. One of the other areas we're really concerned about budget-wise is the Oregon State University Experiment Station Extension and Forest Research Laboratories. They have had their personnel cut by about 80 FTEs over the course of the last decade. We're hoping to see some of that restored. We view money spent on those facilities not as an expenditure but as an investment in Oregon, because they do pay back handsomely with returns on investment to the resources of Oregon. The bill that I had mentioned that Representative Nolan helped us pass in 2001, the Fertilizer Control Act, there is a bill to update or modernize that. We will be working and supporting those updates. That's a very important act, and I think it's doing its intended purpose. We will probably work in a coalition effort. There appears to be an attempt to, I think it would be the great grandson of an attempt to limit harvest on state-owned forests. The aftermath of the Ballot Measure 34 defeat, we'll be working with our natural resource allies in the forest products industry to try to ensure that doesn't happen. There is a bill that will ban biotechnology, primarily I think it's focused on biopharma and bioindustrial chemical manufacture in Oregon. We will be opposing that bill. And we'll be trying to work collaboratively on something with regard to PERS, the Pesticide Use Reporting System. But I think we have to take a look at, you can break that issue down into perhaps two, if not three, different segments and dissect it that way and analyze it. I think there's a funding component, obviously. The current situation is that the funding mechanism that's in statute allows or requires that half of the funding come from a surcharge on the registration of pesticides. The other half must come from general fund. And the intent of that, I think, is very clear, that there is the purpose of the program is a general benefit type of program, and it also does one major thing, and that is it forces the legislature to do its primary function, which is to appropriate and prioritize money. If we have a situation where dollars are very limited and there are many competing programs, it basically ensures that these programs will be looked at with some sort of comparative glasses, so to speak, as opposed to, as you steal one of the governor's lines, always analyzing programs in isolation. They all look great in isolation until you start stacking them up and say, we have limited dollars, where should we spend them? That being said, the budget side is obviously is an area that is totally in your hands in terms of whether or not there is funding for a program of this nature. The other end of it, I think, deals more with the details that are in statute and how the program will be implemented. And I think that's where some of us have some significant differences in terms of how the program should be implemented on the ground. The number one area of conflict between the two opposing sides on this issue is the area of reporting with regard to agriculture and forestry. And that continues to be an area of debate. The other area that we have a very strong feeling on is the extension of the sunset on the bill, and that's one that we have a very difficult time agreeing to extend the program out based upon how we got to where we're at right now. Rather than take up any more time, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions that folks may have, anything that I touched on or didn't touch on.
Thank you, Terry. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed the connector at the very end. You said you were opposed to something about the sunset on a bill. I missed which bill we were talking about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we're talking about bills that are dealing with the reauthorization or refunding of the pesticide use reporting system.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you.
Give your best to your colleague. Hope she's feeling better. Farm Bureau, Greg Addington, Katie Fast. Not in that order necessarily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau. With me is Katie Fast. I thought what we'd do is just give you a kind of a brief overview of our organization, of the industry that we represent, and then talk a little bit about, I'll talk briefly about a couple of my issues, and I'll turn it over to Katie to go into some of her issues. The Oregon Farm Bureau is the largest general agricultural organization in the state. We represent over 8,500 farm and ranch families throughout the state. We are formed as a federation, meaning that when a person joins our organization, they join our county farm bureau. Our counties form together to form the Oregon Farm Bureau, and then we, along with the other 49 states, make up the American Farm Bureau Federation, which works on national issues. I think y'all have a sheet in front of you that kind of gives talks about the organization and as well as about our industry. I just wanted to highlight a few things out of there. When you get to the bottom of that first page about Oregon agriculture, I think the thing that stands out the most is the diversity of our state and the commodities we produce. And you get a little sample of that on the left-hand side of the page there of the many, well over 200 commodities that we produce in this state. Another interesting fact is that over 93% of the farms in the state are in individual or family ownership. Many times we hear reference to corporate farming, and while in fact there are many families that will form a corporation, they are still owned and managed by the family unit. Of those farms in this state, we're estimating, but about 1,800 of them have been in operation for well over 100 years. So this is an industry with a long history in the state, the beginnings of this state. Moving on to the economics, value of products that leave the farm, that's a truckload of wheat as it leaves the farm, the farm gate value of products in the state is about $4 billion per year. When you factor in the processing, the transportation, and other activities, that total economic impact increases about another $4 billion to close to $8 billion. That accounts for about 9% of the gross state product. On the other side of that sheet, just briefly about some of the trade issues, about 80% of our products in this that we produce here in Oregon leave the state. The Pacific Rim, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan make up the top three recipients of our products. And an interesting note is that Japan consumes about the same dollar value of Oregon ag products as Oregonians do. We often think of agriculture as a rural activity, and while the production aspect of it certainly is in many cases, we have a partner in the city of Portland. The Port of Portland, 40% of U.S. grain exports come through the Port of Portland. That's nationwide, 40% of the exports. That makes it the nation's largest grain exporting facility and the third largest in the world. Nearly two-thirds of the Port of Portland's shipping volume is in agricultural products. 43% of Oregon's land is in private ownership. The remainder is mostly in federal ownership, Forest Service and BLM. About 60% of the private land is in agricultural production. In terms of labor, agriculture is Oregon's number two industry, employs more than 150,000 workers in production, processing, transportation, input industries, and marketing, and that represents about 8% of the total jobs in the state, or 1 in 12 jobs can be traced to agriculture. With that, at the bottom of that sheet is just some interesting information about our top commodities that we produce here, and some of the commodities that we rank first in the country in producing. And then, Mr. Chair, with your permission, we'll just kind of briefly touch on a few of the issues that we see this session. I should mention that while Katie and I are here, there are three of us that lobby full-time for Farm Bureau. The third member of our team, Don Schellenberg, isn't here today. Katie and I's focus is more on much of the natural resource, environmental, commodity-specific issues. Don focuses on taxes, labor issues, and land use. So just from my perspective, the issues that I will be keeping an eye on and working on this session may or may not pertain or come before this committee, but I thought I'd just put them on your radar screen anyway. If you haven't heard already, which I'm sure you have, there will be some discussion of wolves this session. And I'm not sure what form that will take, but we will certainly be involved in that and have a seat at the table to look out for the concerns of our members on that issue. There are, as in any session, any number of water issues. I focus on some of the wetland issues as they pertain to farming, and specifically a little term called fill and removal, which is regulated by the Division of State Lands. I expect there will be some issues this session about what activities can and can't occur in a wetland or in a bed and bank of a stream. We plan to be involved there to try to get some clear understanding of what we can and cannot do. there are increasingly animal health issues are a concern. BSE has been a concern in the past. We're actively involved and supportive of a national animal identification system. There's a pilot program here in Oregon that we're supporting and trying to work out the bugs to make sure that we can have accurate trace back of any kind of a disease outbreak. On the plant side of things, sudden oak death is still a huge concern. It's something that could really hamper our industry, devastate the nursery industry here in the state. So we continue to be involved in any of those kind of issues, working with the Department of Agriculture. Another kind of in the bigger picture is the whole fire funding, fire protection issues in the state. Many of our landowners are farmers and ranchers, but also have timberland. Fire protection is always an issue, as you all well know, and the adequate funding, adequate resources for that. And I think with that, I will turn it over to Katie to get into some of her issues and go from there.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. This session, I'll be dealing with issues for the Farm Bureau within water, transportation, crop production and protection, commodity commissions, and energy. Besides the renewable energy issue that I'll touch on last, I don't have a big environmental issues that I'll be pushing for this session for the Farm Bureau, more watching bills that are coming from other organizations and agencies and dealing with them as they come. I would like to talk about regulations that farmers are under and the environmental aspect and the business aspect of those. Those regulations need to find a balance between the environment and our farmers' ability to produce crops and provide for their families and their communities. Farm Bureau is very concerned that regulations are based in science and that as regulations are put on the farm community, they have a scientific basis to them and can be proved to meet the goals that the agency or the legislature is hoping to achieve. We fall not only under environmental regulations, but also regulations that face other businesses in the transportation arena, labor regulations, taxes, and food safety as well. So the cost of doing business for Oregon's farmers is increasing each year. We at Farm Bureau are very concerned with getting the education on regulations out to farmers. We do that through a monthly newsletter, through a published magazine as well. We are also very supportive of some of the state institutions that give information to the farm community dealing with either new laws coming into effect or also how to meet the environmental regulations. And the two big ones are probably soil and water conservation districts and the Extension Service. Those are two agencies that we'll see some cuts to in the governor's proposed budgets that we're concerned about just maintaining their current service level. They're based in the communities. They have county offices. They're part of the community for the farm and ranchers, and there's relationships there. They don't feel threatened to call those offices and get advice, and they're a great resource. Other assistance to the farm and ranch community is through federal and state funding for environmental programs. Federally, we have the USDA, which administers the Farm Bill, which has EQIP dollars, CREP dollars, and others to administer environmental restoration projects. ODF&W is also receiving some wildlife habitat dollars, which are getting administered down for different programs dealing with not only fish habitat, but also our game and threatened species. Here in the state, we have the Measure 66 dollars that are administered through OWEB. Those go out through watershed councils, also have grant programs to assist farmers in increasing their irrigation programs, increasing their stream restoration that goes through their property. and Farm Bureau just keeps a good lookout on those dollars to make sure they're getting to the ground, they're not being sucked up through administrative processes. We have concerns with those funds being used to purchase public or purchase private property with public funds and to take those out of the public sector. That is decreasing our farmland in the state. It also impacts the communities. Those projects many times don't need to pay taxes to the counties. They are no longer generating funds for the community and generating jobs. We're also concerned on the environmental side on our neighbors, and that would be the biggest landowner in the state, the federal government, and the management of those lands. Many of our members are ranchers that have public land permits to graze cattle on those lands. We're also concerned with the weed issue in the federal government and noxious weeds. That has a large economic impact to our state. It impacts our private lands and our ability to raise crops and have a weed-free pasture land as well. The weed program at ODA, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, is probably not adequately funded. And we've been working probably the past two interims with ODA and other interests on trying to find some way to increase the funding for that program. And I don't think there's any solid answers yet, but we'll continue to be working on that. The last issue I'd like to talk about is renewable energy. Farm Bureau has been involved in supporting renewable energy. I have two handouts dealing with ethanol and biofuels for you. Our members are involved in wind development projects in the Columbia Gorge and leasing out their land or putting easements on them for wind development. And we're interested in seeing how we can help in streamlining those projects and helping them get off the ground. Solar is used in off-site grazing. So people can use small solar pumps and be able to pump water from the stream up to an upland and have cattle graze away from the stream, and they aren't coming down to that sensitive area to water. Also, you'll be interested to know Kettle Foods here in Salem has their entire roof covered with solar panels, and they use that to supply a large percentage of their energy. And you wouldn't think Salem is a big sunny spot, but it's possible here. Microhydro is an interest to irrigation districts that are a big user of energy. They can put in those projects and start supplying some of their own energy and also selling it in the grid as well. Geothermal is an issue in Klamath Falls area. We have a member who heats his greenhouses with the hot water coming out of the ground, and then also uses that water on tropical fish ponds on his ranch in Klamath Falls. And you'd never think you'd see tropical fish that are bright yellow, green, and blue being grown in the ground at Klamath Falls. And the last is biofuels and ethanol. Oregon has a large grass seed industry here in the Willamette Valley, and we're interested in providing another rotation crop for that industry that will actually improve their production of grass seed when they can grow maybe a canola or another crop that will produce oils for biodiesel. Ethanol can be produced from our grass straw or also from wheat, and in the Ontario area, there is now, they're starting to site a ethanol plant, but that'll take wheat and barley from the Treasure Valley area and Malheur County in Oregon as well. That plant, the primary goal of it is to produce a high-protein fish food, and the ethanol is really a byproduct. But it's a big interest. We're needing to find ways to diversify our crops as we enter into a global market, and the price that we used to receive in crops is maybe narrowing as our expenses go up. And so any way that our ranchers can, or farmers can find new ways of production, we're supportive of. I'd like to add there will probably be legislation with a renewable fuel standard. I think Farm Bureau will be supportive of that. It's interesting to note that Washington, Montana, and Idaho legislators will also be looking at renewable fuel standards. So there's a big potential for a market in the Northwest. Tied with that, however, to benefit Oregon agriculture, I believe there needs to be incentives for businesses to move here in Oregon and set up those plants and purchase Oregon crops. And the legislation that will be coming to the legislature has those incentives. Not sure if they're the right mix yet, but we'll be working on them within our members that are interested in that and trying to find what's the best incentive to bring those companies here, because it probably isn't the biggest benefit to us to have a renewable standard if they aren't using Oregon crops. And with that, we'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I'd like to just mention that this committee will be hearing from a firm similar to the biodiesel that their interest as well is in developing either green crops or food waste or wood product waste that can be turned into alcohols for use in conserving gasoline, diesel, whatever. And also the idea of developing possibly some tax credits or some credits that could be traded to bring other businesses to the state that might not be able to make it under the margins of airshed quality. But we're interested in this field. I think Representative Smith is having hearings on biodiesel.
On Friday, yeah.
Yeah, and so we'll be listening to things along the same lines and be communicating. Representative Garrard.
Katie, Oregon's Renewable Energy Center is located at Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls. Do you have any contact, or are you working along with them in the search for alternate energy? Do they figure in your plans at all?
Chair Anderson and Representative Gerard, not at this time, but you know, I think we'll be interested in contacting them. Also, Oregon State University is the recipient of the federal Sun Grant that is for the Northwest, and they are in charge of distributing those dollars out to the land-grant universities in the West for renewable energy projects. But if you possibly have I'll check with you afterwards and see if you have a good contact at Klamath Falls. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Finally, John Ledger, AOI. Thank you for being so patient today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's 2:30, so I have, what, 2.5 hours?
No, it's not right. We don't, but
you want to talk to yourself.
Turn the lights out.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Vice President of Associated Oregon Industries. We are the largest business association in the state. We have just members of about every type of business and industry that exists in the state. I handle environmental affairs, and AOI has a very active environmental program. Our environment committee, which actually is split into several subcommittees like water and air, is about a total of about 350 members. And it's split, probably about 20% environmental attorneys, and I guess the balance split between industry people and consultants that in Oregon is a pretty good business. And I often think on things like the harbor cleanup, you know, we have the companies that have to do the cleanup and the consultants that get paid to do the studies and the attorneys that get paid to kind of sort it all out. So, you know, regardless of what happens, somebody's making money. It's my third. But we are very active working with the DEQ. We work very closely with them. One of the things I wanted to talk about was in Oregon that is a little different is we probably have the best relationship between the industrial community and the regulatory agency in the country. And this has gone on for quite a while. It's kind of an Oregon tradition. If you look at a lot of the literature that comes out of some of the other states, I mean, it's pretty scorched earth and pretty brutal. There are very few lawsuits between industry and the agency, and we work very closely with them. Our environment committees that review rules works very closely with the agency, and we've been very pleased with the management changes that have gone in with the DEQ. We think it's a very well-managed agency. We'll be seeing a couple of DEQ bills come over here regarding their water program, including a fee increase. If the bills come over as we expect to see them, we'll be supportive of those bills. I don't see us having any loggerheads with the agency this go-around in the session at all. We're supportive of them. A couple of other things I want to quickly say, that it's unusual in Oregon. In many states, there are statutes on the books that make it illegal for the state to be more stringent or tougher than the federal minimum requirements. That's a common state statute. Oregon does not have that, with one small exception that is kind of an esoteric thing relating to kind of a federal delegation of air permits. And we have not sought that. DEQ works primarily by getting people together, stakeholder groups, and kind of, frankly, just grinding through the process often. We are supportive of a DEQ program that established a sort of a special state air toxics program. And it took them 4 years to get that done. And there were long meetings. And, you know, we bought into it. They did a good job, and we support it. So I think as long as things kind of go along in those lines where we can work together cooperatively, I think you're going to continue to see a good relationship. Industry also in Oregon historically has gotten a, because the rules are stricter and there are programs here that are not required, industry in this state has gotten a tax break through the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program. So it kind of takes the edge off the extra expense that industries have here when they operate here or they locate here. And that also helps, I think, build a good relationship. I wanted to just show you, I'm not going to talk a lot about bills that are coming over, but I wanted to show you, perhaps if we could pass this out, just a couple of things that I think often surprise people. And this is coming around. Very often when you see polls, if you ask people, how is the environment doing, the bulk of people say they think it's getting worse. And every single survey of numbers, actual study of numbers, shows that the contrary is the case. And what you have in front of you now are a couple of graphs. This one's right off of the EPA webpage. I took it off today on the first page. And this is nationally, but it's similar for here. And it shows a comparison of growth in air and emissions, in this case air emissions in the country. And you'll see gross domestic product going up 176% since 1970, and air emissions, even with a population growth, have dropped in half. So that's good news. And this is common through the country. If you look on the second page, I think it's the back side, here's a plot, and this is closer to home. And what this is exceedances of federal air quality health limits. An exceedance is a little bit different than a standard break. It's a more sensitive measure. Anywhere in the state for all pollutants. And so you can see in 1978, statewide, there were about 350 exceedances of the federal health limit, which is pretty awful. And then you can see it dropping down, and by about 1994, we're down to just about zero, and we're kind of bumping along the bottom since then. There are no areas in the state of Oregon now that are in non-attainment for federal health standards, not a one. There have been some bumps where the federal health standards have been violated, and they were because the monitor was located next to a forest fire. And EPA allows you to discount those. So the only problems we've had are related to forest fires. The next chart, just kind of looking at water, is dissolved oxygen levels, and fish need oxygen to survive. And when you have a lot of nitrates and things in the water, get algae blooms, the fish die, they don't have the water. So it's a measure of water quality. And you can see in 1960, the water quality was pretty crummy. There weren't really enough to support salmonids, and now it's looking much better. And this was on the Willamette. So the Willamette River is improving, too. The one area I think that probably has not improved much is solid waste generation. And when you look at what's happening there, people are generating a lot of solid waste. And I think a lot of that is packaging. I know I go to the store and I bring home something, and it's amazing the amount of packaging for a little item. And it's a mass of plastic and cardboard, a lot of styrofoam, and I think that's probably, the one thing that's going in the wrong direction. The next chart, which is this kind of pinky one with the pie charts, and I wanted to talk a little bit about where pollution comes from. In the 50s, industry was pretty much unregulated, as was everything. I remember our cars had no emission controls on them. Most businesses didn't. Things were just sort of straight piped. I lived in Los Angeles. I remember we had an incinerator in the backyard, and my dad and I would take all the garbage and trash every day out and burn it in the incinerator. It was great fun. But right now, when we look at, we went through the 70s and the Clean Air Act, and when you go and you look through the emission numbers, industry, which, you know, it's industrial sources on the air side, is now about 6 or 7, somewhere between 3 and 7%, depending on how you count it. Now, of course, sometimes that's concentrated, and that's when you have to be careful, because it's different having a big amount spread out or a small amount concentrated. On the water side, we've had huge reductions. On the water side, it's about, you know, no one knows for sure, but industry plus municipalities is usually quoted as about 15%. And I would guess industry is about half of that, because some is a direct discharge from industry, and we know what that is very closely, and some industries discharge into municipal systems, which discharge. So you have to kind of double count that in a way. But there have been great, there's been a lot of improvement on that. There's a fascinating film that Representative Jensen may want to show in your committee, and it's a film that was taken about 1940, and it's this guy, a professor, has a cage, and the way he measured pollution in the Willamette was he put fish in this cage, then he lowered it into the Willamette with a stopwatch, and he timed how long it took them to die. And it's just an amazing film because it didn't take them long. And there are pictures of, you know, just red effluent, yellow, gold effluent just running directly into the river. There was no sewage treatment plants, just all went into the river. It was a pretty amazing film just to watch. So things have gotten a lot better. The next page, we're talking about air pollution on air toxics. Industry is about 9% of that. So we've made great progress. It's been expensive, but you made great progress, especially in the 70s and 80s, where you're going from no controls, essentially, and you're going to 95% controls. You get a lot of bang for your buck. The last chart on there that I want to talk about briefly, because this is another misconception, is people hear that, you know, the 1990 Clean Air Act, so nothing has happened since then. But what happens with the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act is it sets up a series of events that essentially go on forever. So like I know a lot of people here are familiar with the water side, the TMDL development, total daily maximum load. You have streams that aren't meeting permit, you know, requirements or in-stream requirements, so you have to go and do retrofits or whatever to meet those standards. There are always federal standards that are new coming down the pike that are requiring upgrades, and there are some state-only programs that Oregon has that aren't required. And it's the same on the air side. They went through and they looked at, on the 1990 Clean Air Act, they went through the industry and they said, we're going to identify the 12% best operations for each type of industry, whether it be lead or metals or whatever, incinerators. And over the years, we're going to rewrite the rules so everybody has to come up to that best 12%. It's called MACT standards, and those are rolling out now. So there are a lot of companies in Oregon that are going to be putting on a lot of new control equipment to meet the MACT standards. And then once that's done, the federal government is going to take another run, which is it will develop what's called residual risk, and it will go back to the same facilities and do another analysis to see if there was any residual risk left to the population. And then that will cause another rollout of rulemaking and retrofitting. On top of that, you have the usual standards that come out that you have to meet. And there's also things like new source performance standards. And these are really interesting. You remember there was a big flap nationally about power plants having to retrofit. And what would happen would be the power plants, just to give you an idea, the power plants would have to replace their boiler tubes because they wear out and they get all corroded up. They don't operate very well. Huge boiler tubes. And if you replaced your boiler tubes, EPA would say, you're now a new source. You're brand new. You replaced your boiler tubes. Those are expensive. You spent a lot of money. You're a new source. Now you have to retrofit just as if you were a brand new plant. And that's what that fight was about. So it caused some companies not to retrofit their tubes as soon as they should have. They're less efficient. You get more pollution. It was kind of a mess. And then you, again, have state-only requirements and upgrades that are going on. So this is going to roll forward, you know, over the next 15 years or so. And it's a logical progression in many ways in that as technology gets better, measurement devices get better. You expect that to go along with it. But one of the things that I am concerned about that I often hear is that, you know, things are not getting better or that the standards are not changing or keeping up. As I said, I'll come around and I'll probably be talking with you individually as bills come over. We're not expecting to see a whole lot that we hope, anyway. And with that, I'd be happy to address any questions.
Oh, he can't get off.
Thank you. Well, I got a question for you, and that is there, do you know, John, if there's a standard of statute of limitations on incineration in your backyard?
Like if I could still do it? I'll tell you an interesting fact. 20 people open burning their household garbage puts out as much dioxin as I think it's a 200 ton per day municipal incinerator. Just 20 people. And it's amazing. But it was fun.
If I might, and I'm sure Mr. Ledger will be back before us, and so we can give him an opportunity to be grilled later. But, John, you gave us some historic comparisons that go back 20, 30 or more years, and it's actually refreshing to see the big improvements that have been made. There are chemicals, there is material, there are processes that are in use now that we didn't dream of 30 years ago. And how does that affect your analysis that things are so much better than they were in the 70s?
That there are things.
We weren't dealing with PCs, for example. The earlier witness talked about the electronic equipment disposal of that, and all of the chemicals and other things that are in that, and some of the manufacturing processes that go along with that didn't exist. So how do we put that in historic context?
The way that I think gets put in historic, well, first of all, a lot of times we don't know what was emitted, because we didn't measure for this stuff. And if you have emissions from a plant, for instance, that produces some type of a plasticizer or organics, usually you have a spread of organics. And there could have been all kinds of things in there, but nobody monitored for them, nobody measured for them, and a lot of times we couldn't. But that's one of the functions of, like, the MACT standards, is that's exactly what it's supposed to do, and residual risk from the industrial side. Now, the kind of the other piece to that, you know, that's the emission side. The other piece to that is how do you regulate what society uses, you know, as opposed to emissions, because it's, you know, like in a product. And that kind of, you know, that kind of falls into different agencies and a different process. But I don't think you're looking for what you talked about at a lot of emissions that have that kind of a link. I think where you might be seeing it is in product use more.
I think with that, we're going to have to call our session to allow the next group to get in. A lot of questions I think we're going to want to talk to you about, John, in terms of when regulations are put on, who should pay for them? Should the business, who's make a profit? Yes. Should the public, who wants these standards? Yes, maybe. Let's have that dialogue at some future time.
I'd like to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
Thanks.